How do you know if you're fulfilling God's purpose for you? Now, maybe we need to back up a little bit. How do you know what God's purpose for you is? And does your purpose have more to do with what you do or with who you are? And one more question, if your purpose has to do with who you are, as a leader, as a pastor, as a child of God, how do you become more fully that person, right? The person that you are meant to be? Well, today I'm talking with Jim Wilder about how we become who we are created to be. But we don't approach it in the conventional way. We approach it through the lens of neurotheology. In other words, what role does your brain, the brain that God created and through which God works, what role does your brain play in forming you into the person that you were created to be? And how can an understanding of how the brain works help us as leaders develop environments in our churches that nurture deep spiritual formation among our people and help them both become who they were created to be and fulfill the purpose for which they were created? This is a great conversation. I'm so excited to share this with you. I'm Marcus Watson, and this is episode 179 of Spiritual Life and Leadership. Hey everyone, I'm here with Jim Wilder. Jim is the author of Renovated and also the resident neurotheologian at Life Model Works. Hi Jim, how are you doing?
All right, great to be with you, Marcus.
I'm so glad to have you here. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, I think about how the human brain and body system works together with God's design. Sort of in the idea, like if God created a hardware, which would be our body and mind, he would want his operating system, which is what theology and scripture is about, to run together really well. And, you know, how do those two things overlap and work together? And that's what I like to think about, write about, talk about that. So I got a job doing that.
That's great. That's great. And I was just sharing you right before we started recording that title, Neurotheologian. I love it. Tell us, and you've kind of explained a little bit about what that is just in what you do, but can you say a little bit about that title, what that means to be a neurotheologian?
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to the year 400, roughly, when the Bishop Nemesius of Emesa started writing about the brain and how it forms personality and character. And that was sort of the book for about 1,500 years, and then since then, science has been saying, oh, well, you know, we could add a little bit to what Nemesius knew about how it actually works. And so, you know, that's kind of the background behind the book Renovated, because Dallas Willard and I were having a dialogue about whether natural development or normal human maturity was a continuum with spiritual maturity. How do those two things go together? And so working in that was, you know, something actually got started for me when I was at Fuller with Lee Travis. He was my early mentor. And so he was the first one that brought up the topic to me. You know, the brain must be designed to work with how God designed us. So let's look at it.
I love that.
That's where I got my spark.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, good. Well, I want to ask you before we get into talking about the book and all the stuff that's in that. A quick little get to know you question, Jim. And what the question is: what job would you be terrible at?
Oh, there's no question at all. Sports commentator would be it.
Okay.
Yeah. To keep track of all of those names and to track what's happening on the field and comment on it and keep aware of all of that, I'd be like, now, who's that guy over there? And how do you know? I would just be so lost. You know, traveling large groups, all those things are just like, you know, I like my life in the nice quiet woods and think slowly about one topic a long time.
That's right. Do you enjoy sports?
Oh, yeah. I follow soccer all the time.
Okay.
I listen to those guys go on. I'm just amazed every time I do.
I know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do that either. I tried years ago playing, actually a few different times playing like fantasy football. Mm-hmm. And I just, tracking statistics, even with the ease with which you can do it now with computers versus when I, the first time I tried, I just like, this is not life-giving to me. You know, I have no interest in tracking stats and all that stuff. But anyway, great. Well, I love it. Well, good. Well, I'm excited to talk about your book, Renovated. Maybe the first question I would ask is just sort of what's the problem or the challenge that your book is addressing? And also, you know, you can talk about, as you're explaining this, I thought it was so interesting that the book, in a sense, is a reflection and an expansion on a particular conference that you did with Dallas Willard. And so maybe talk a little bit about that, too.
Yeah, well, the dialogue that we were having at that time really was, how do you get transformation? And Dallas Willard is pretty passionate about that, and so am I. And so healing kind of gets you back to where you normally were, or you're supposed to be, but transformation is supposed to move you beyond that. And so what is actually involved in transformation? How do people go through that? You know, it's obviously spiritual as well as has to do something because it's got to run in your body and your mind. Mm-hmm. And so we are doing that in the context of talking about natural maturity then. So is it possible to be spiritually mature and not be naturally mature at all? And that's basically how the church is run for a while. It's like, okay, well, our spiritual maturity is its own little thing over here. And we don't have to pay any attention to natural maturity. But since we're running a counseling center, suppose part of natural maturity, for instance, is to be able to distinguish another person from a rock or a tree. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your brain has to be able to do that. So let's say we delete that part of natural maturity, how to recognize a human and relate to them as part of spiritual maturity. Do you still have spiritual maturity left over? And, you know, it becomes sort of obvious, I think, to most of us that if I don't recognize a person, it's going to be very hard to be mature of any kind. So the human factors are playing in there. And maybe since the human factors all turn out to be essentially relational, is it possible that spiritual maturity is also a relational thing, in which case we should have a pretty strong overlap? And that's the thing that Dallas and I were discussing. And we're both of the opinion that spiritual and natural maturity are part and parcel of each other. That maybe, let's say, spiritual maturity is natural maturity plus. So not something separate, but something beyond and built on natural maturity. And so that's this book is a dialogue about that.
Yeah, that's great. Makes me think of Pete Scazzaro and his work on emotionally healthy spirituality. And he says that you can't be spiritually mature without being emotionally mature. I think something like that. I may be paraphrasing, but
That's similar right there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And it makes sense. And so, you know, you talk about a few sort of important concepts that I think language that we don't necessarily use in our everyday conversations, but which are important to growing spiritually, becoming spiritually mature. Two that kind of stood out to me are attachment, love, and then being in a state of mutual mind. And the second one especially was so interesting to me, but I'd love to talk about those. What is attachment love and what's the role of attachment love in becoming spiritually mature?
Well, the thing that's basic to the human body and biology is that we form our identity by attachment to another person. And so whether we're looking at, you know, why do little ducklings follow mama duck or whoever they see at the time, you know, that imprinting, this is my kind of people. And I'm, you know, the brain is basically looking for a larger mind with which to get some help in organizing myself. So whenever we're lost or we don't know who to be, we're looking for somebody else who knows how to do this, a brain sort of designed to look for a greater mind. Now, if God's that greater mind, but he's interpreted to us first through our parents and the minds that love us, how does that actually happen? And the brain has sort of a firewall, you might say, in it. It won't let someone in to tell me who I am or set up my identity unless I have an attachment with them. And the attachment forms with people who are glad to be with me. That response to somebody else who's joyful, glad to be with me, looks, their eyes light up, they go like, wow, it's you. That is where our brain begins to form an attachment. And once we have that attachment, then that person gains the right to tell us who we really are and who we can be. Now, suppose that our relationship with God is supposed to work the same way, that somehow attaching to God has something to do with loving him. And God's being glad to be with us. And then by forming love, you know, it would make love, attachment love, central to what the gospel is talking about. You know, that basically by that connection with God, we come to know who we are and who we have a potential to become. And so that's attachment love. It comes from that joy, like you feed me, you take care of me, you look after me, you do all those sorts of things with the Bible actually in the Old Testament calls chesed, the word for that kind of, you know, care for another person that, that lasts, you know, like we're going to stay together in this. And that's what attachment love is like.
And, you know, how do you develop that kind of attachment love with God? Because God, you know, for many people is very intangible, and he is intangible. You know, we don't see him. We don't touch him. We don't literally see his eyes light up when he looks at us, though we can perhaps imagine it. But how do we develop that kind of attachment love with God and with Jesus?
Well, Mr. Attachment, as I would call the Apostle John, says that if you can't do attachment with people who you have seen, how can you do it with God who you haven't seen? And so essentially, John sets it up to say, we have to practice attachment with each other. We have to develop joyful, loving relationships with other people, out of which our brain, he doesn't talk about the brain, but I will, comes to understand and have some way of actually responding to this is how God could be. And then life in the spirit would mean that God's not inert, that somehow he can activate that sense of being loved and seen. And so scripture continues to talk about God's face, his countenance, lighting up when he sees us, singing over us. And so it seems to be that, again, this interchange, partly people we have to practice. If we don't practice with people, it doesn't become real with God. If we don't practice with God, it doesn't become more than we could have with people.
It makes me think of a quote or a statement from Lewis Smedes, who maybe you studied with him. I don't know.
I did. Did I remember him well.
Well, I read his book, Shame and Grace, a few years ago. And he says, and again, paraphrasing here, but something like the way you begin to heal from the feeling of being unacceptable or perhaps unattached or connected to a people, the way you begin to heal from the feeling of being unacceptable is the experience of being accepted, right? Of feeling connected and attached to someone, maybe we would say. And then it makes sense that from there then, and if these people will accept me, then maybe God accepts me too. If I can attach to these people, then maybe I can attach to Jesus as well.
My friend Ed Corey wrote a book called Becoming a Face of Grace, in which he's basically talking about joy and how do you become that for another person so that you share your face with Jesus when looking at others. And that's sort of the practical application. In fact, as far as the brain is concerned, shame is the opposite of joy. It's when somebody's response to you is non-joy, you feel like, oh, no. And that's the shame reaction. So it's the antithesis of joy. And that's Lou Smedes was onto something with that from a more philosophical point of view. But I think he got it right.
Fascinating. I love that. That was such an eye-opening book for me when I read that. Attachment. And so then I'm thinking, okay, so a lot of our listeners are pastors and ministry leaders. And it seems then that part of the goal is for people, let's say somebody comes into our church or we, you know, we're doing ministry in our community and we're loving and serving people. And the hope is for them to enter into connection with their creator and to deepen that connection with Jesus, who gives us meaning, who gives us life. And the way that would happen, here's kind of what I hear you saying, and then correct me if I'm wrong or expand on it. what we want to do is help people attach to the people who are the church, right? So maybe say something about that. And how do we do that? As if you're talking to pastors and ministry leaders, like how do we help people make that attachment?
Well, there's sort of, again, two sides to it that I would talk to people about. One is in order to get people to attach to each other, you have to create an environment of joy where people are glad to be together. Yeah. So the typical thing that happens to people when they start getting a little toasty and burning out in ministry is their joy levels drop. And when your joy levels drop, you're not getting glad to see people. You don't want the phone to ring, one more email, one more meeting, just all, and you start to think about, well, so-and-so is going to get upset and, this is going to bother so-and-so. And this is all these things, steal our joy. And then if work gets too heavy and you're being called away from your family, one of the things that I had from a conversation with a mega church in Korea, the pastor said, we usually stay here in church till about midnight so that when we go home, our families will be asleep because they're all mad at us because we spent so much time at church. And so there's this low joy happening at home often because of the demands of church. And so, these things start, eating your lunch after a while. So one side, you got to build your joy back up again, which is have people that are glad to be with you. That's a relational thing. And the second side is you have to have some kind of interactive sense of God's presence. In other words, when you can't really be all that glad to be to be with all the irritating things about people, right? you have to see in them something that God loves.
Yeah.
Or you're not glad to be with them. And so the pastoral ministry is I can see in you what God wants to build, even though you don't see it in yourself. Yeah. I can see what God wants to form in you. And then that has to come from the Holy Spirit. Yeah. So I look at these very annoying people and I go like, I know you're very annoying. And Jesus says, how long do I have to put up with you anyway? Because they annoyed him too. I mean, everybody's annoying. But to see in them, God sees something in you. That's his grace. I see in you something that I'm going to grow. Yeah. That has to come from the Spirit. But if we're all drained physically and have no joy in our life, it's really hard for the Spirit side to carry us very far. And if we're just going to build it on the Spirit, the human side, and say well, let's just look for the people that are enjoyable, we'll soon run out of that. So again, this both sides have to be built up. And that's typically not what we think about as leading a church.
Yeah.
That's more task oriented. It's production.
Right. So what I'm thinking about is how challenging that can be. What advice or tips or thoughts would you offer to a pastor who's like, I'm just having a really hard time enjoying the people that I'm with and making them feel like they can experience joy here,
Well, the number one thing that seems to happen is that we lose our peace. And to find our way back to peace, the brain's best path is through being thankful. So one of the things Dallas Willard used to say is he would wake up every morning before he'd get out of bed, he'd spend 5 minutes being thankful. And then before going to sleep, he'd spend 5 minutes being thankful. Often ran a little longer with him. And in the middle of the day at lunchtime is not a bad time to stop and spend 5 minutes being thankful. And if we can go enter into God's presence with thanksgiving, it's been said someplace. if you can find something to be thankful for, especially sometime that God's been with you and present with you, and you can be thankful for that, keep going back to that. It sort of restores your sense of looking for joy. And it's a peaceful place. It's like, oh, this feels good to be here.
Yeah,
and we can actually retrain our brain to make that our normal. So your brain actually sets its normal emotional state about 18 months of age. And, you know, if your life's in a turmoil there, your parents are fighting or, you know, you're sort of by yourself. You know, you get lonely and all kinds of things as your normal. But by practicing appreciation, we can make that our normal. It makes it that much easier to stay in a joyful state. Rushing and, you know, to get results is the enemy of all of that. It's basically fear-based. So we have to purge our life of the things we do out of fear, which is what spiritual disciplines are good for. And then we have to begin to build appreciation and thankfulness for everything that's good and life-giving and whatever is from above and full of life, to start thinking on those things. You've heard these things before, I'm sure.
Sure, but that's it, right? That's why we've heard them before, probably for a couple thousand years at least, right? And beyond, longer than that. And then what I'm hearing from you is kind of like the why. Here's why this is actually important.
That's how it works. That's the fun part I have.
Yeah. There's, you know, as I'm looking at my list of questions here, I'm like, oh my gosh, there are so many things that I want to talk about from your book, and there's so many things we can learn. But I want to also talk about another concept that you talk about in the book called mutual mind, being a state of mutual mind, which is an expression I'd never really heard before. Can you explain what that is and why that matters?
The developmental and neuropsychologists call it intersubjectivity. Because it runs faster than the conscious mind, so it feels subjective to us. Mm-hmm. But actually, from the right side of the brain to my right brain to your right brain and back again, we send messages back and forth, complete cycle, 6 times a second.
Wow.
And so if we're tuned into each other, what you can do visually, I can kind of watch, if I knew you well enough, I could watch what you're doing and watch your expression. You probably have had people when you look at them and you go, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Oh, yeah, right.
Or that moment when you sit and look into somebody's eyes and you begin to feel the same thing for each other, you know. Sometimes it's we're both mad at each other, and sometimes it's like, it's you. That's really special. But either way, we begin to develop the same emotional expressions, same thoughts, everything at the same time. Well, the brain is set to pick that up and run faster than conscious thought, which runs at 5 cycles per second. So it's always behind this intersubjectivity. And if we're tuned into each other that way, we've got an attachment, our brains begin to produce the same chemistry, the same thoughts, use the same patterns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, have you ever had the experience where you saw two people get together, one of them says, you're making me mad, and the other says, no, you're making me mad. Or, you're making me smile. No, you're making me smile. It's because us is making us mad, or us is making us smile. That's mutual mind state. And the brain is designed to do that. And that's how it actually copies bigger brains. So a little baby is looking to form a mutual mind with somebody and figure out how to be human. You know, when we go to calculus class, we're looking around for somebody that goes like, you understand what they're talking about here? And we're looking for a greater mind that can say, it works like this. And we go, huh, say that again. And after a few repetitions, we go like, oh, now I can think that way too. And whether it's intellectual or emotional or relational, these moments of mutual mind are when we form ourselves into someone greater than we would have been otherwise. Mm-hmm. And it runs roughly inside the brain about 12 cycles per second. So you can actually run the frequency in there, and you can see like, we're running much faster than conscious mind can go. In it, it's for figuring out who we are and how we relate to the world and how I connect with other people in the world. It's a fun process. It's been called all kinds of things. tacit knowledge was what Polanyi called it in philosophy of science. And, but, you know, we know more than we can put into words, and that is what forms in this mutual mind space.
And then what's the connection to spiritual formation? How what role does that play?
Well, mutual mind is the way that our identity is formed. And it's, again, based on an attachment, runs faster than conscious mind. So I asked the question, and you know, I think I may be the first one to ask the question, at least in using these words.
Okay.
Would you think that God would build a mechanism like that into your brain and not use it himself? In other words, if that's what's designed to form your human identity, is there any chance that God doesn't want to use attachment to mutual mind with him to form our spiritual identity as well, to take it beyond the human limits and go like, well, yeah, that's being very human. That's very good. But we've got more. There's more to you than that. And the test that Dallas always used to use was, do you spontaneously love your enemies? Now, at a normal human level, we might love our neighbors, you know, and we certainly can love our people we know, at least intermittently. You know, sometimes they annoy us. But, you know, how do you spontaneously do that? Well, you need to have a mutual mind in live and in color when you run into somebody that, that wishes you harm.
Yeah.
And you say, well, you know, but I see how God sees you right now.
Right.
And if God would use that mechanism, then he'd actually have access to our identity and would allow us to transform into somebody we've never been. And so back to transformation. If you want to use a human brain, you're going to have an attachment and it's going to have to be a mutual mind state. And from a practice point of view, you'll need people that can see it too. But suppose God shows you things faster than you can know them that are wonders about yourself, you know? And the identity center is a sort of mirror neurons. They resonate with something that, that they understand, but unless they're activated, we don't even know we have that potential. So suppose God could find potential in us that no one else could see, and the people of God would exercise that potential so we'd get good at it. That would actually allow transformation, but it would all be working through this mutual mind state in which in a mutual mind state, I can't be sure if it's my thinking or God's thinking, if it's my thinking or it's your thinking, because it's sort of mutual. So you'd expect song leaders and preachers to say, well, you know, I have this idea. I wasn't sure it was my idea or God's idea. You know, I have this song, you know, am I sure it's my song or God's song? It's like, well, it's sort of mutual. You know, it seems like we're both thinking about this. You know, I think we've seen sort of subjective evidence that God operates in that space. And whenever pastors are working in that space, they seem energized. They seem like, whoa, something more than just me is happening right here. And they seem to come alive. When it's just tasks and how to keep people from getting upset, that's just not a space that has the same kind of freedom and creativity.
Boy, this is really good. What I'd love to do maybe with the last few minutes that we got here is kind of take those concepts of attachment, love, and mutual mind and think about them in terms of just sort of the challenges of leading in a world that is not like the one that many of us were prepared for. You know, we're certainly in a post-Christendom world. And since COVID, churches have been declining, which is frustrating and scary, creates anxiety and, you know, and burnout. And so just sort of considering the that context, and I was also thinking about spiritual disciplines. It seems to me that spiritual disciplines are certainly one of the ways that we can develop attachment, love, and mutual mind. Is that, would you say yes to that?
Well, what we conclude is they make space for it to develop, but they aren't sufficient in themselves. But if you don't make space, it isn't going to happen anyway. So,
Well, maybe talk about that too. But just sort of, if we can just for a couple of minutes here, just kind of talk about, okay, considering the context that we're in, how can the ideas of attachment, love, and Mutual Mind, and anything else, you know, that maybe we haven't touched on yet, help pastors and leaders and church members really sort of become who they are called to be. You know, we're not just called to be attenders at a Sunday gathering. We're called to be the people of God in the world. And how does all of this help us become that?
Well, first of all, I'd have to say that during the post-Vietnam War, there became a huge professionalization of clergy. And so the professionalization of clergy, if I can say the word, meant that we became a role and a function, and we had to get a job done, and we were rated on how well we got results on that job. It wasn't a question of forming relationships with others. And so most pastors are very clear about what results are expected from them, you know, what the church structure looks like, what people are going to expect them to produce. The idea that you actually formed loving relationships with people has sort of dropped out of the mix. And so now you've got none of the nutrition of spiritual life happening for you, and all the production requirements of secular society being imposed on you. So you'll be judged by your production, not by how well you love, typically. And that's that is not spiritual life. That's not what anybody actually went to seminary desiring to do. Like, I'd really like to get low pay for high production demands, you know, like, so if we go back to, this is about relationship, then relationship depends for its success on God's intelligence. In other words, let's assume that God knows who you're supposed to be, or who he created you to be, right?
And
he knows the situation that you're in. What most of us feel is, I'm the wrong guy for the job, because I don't know how to get results. Which means God was really stupid, because over all the ages, he put you in the wrong place. He just matched you up with a job you couldn't possibly do. But if salvation is about becoming the person God meant us to be, and God was intelligent, then by being exactly who he's creating you to be, you will accomplish what he wants done at the moment. Now the focus of all the spiritual formation becomes to let nothing interfere with my being the person God has created. And furthermore, I'm not going to let anything interfere with the person God's creating in you. So we're going to live into who we're going to be 500 years from now. This is a post-resurrection life that Paul's always talking about. That's actually a great deal of fun. But because it happens faster than the conscious thought can happen, we're always sort of anxious, like, well, is that me thinking or is that God thinking? But knowing the joy of God, experiences in the relationship, it starts with us personally in an unrushed kind of way. You know, as Dallas said, Jesus was never in a hurry. And so we got to take the hurry, the demands off of us, and say, let's just be who God meant us to be. And then we discover that his burden is easy and light, because it's just a matter of being who he created us to be. And by doing so, we're saved, you know. That's a lot of words for a reality I'm only hinting at. But I think some looking in that in a grateful sort of way, like, I'm going to be thankful for who God meant me to be and for who he meant you to be, and we'll start with appreciating that, is not a bad way to start your day and end it either.
I love that. That's that's such a good such a good word, right? Just being and becoming who we were meant to be, and what we're meant to accomplish will flow out of that, right? And it doesn't need to be more. It probably won't be less if you're truly living out of who you're meant to be. There's just a wonderful freedom in that. You don't have to worry about the pressures.
They'll be there, but that's not the ultimate yardstick.
Right. Wow, that's so good. Well, I really appreciate this. Just for our spiritual lives and for the wholeness, so to speak, of our lives, that's so important to remember. You know, a lot of times we talk about here are the things to do or how to address these kinds of challenges, but we also need to become the kind of people, you know, that we're meant to be, become the people that we're meant to be. And then everything, it seems to me, will sort of fall into place.
and ways that are out of our control, that they're left to God's intelligence. Yeah. But instead of becoming things, we become full of life, you know, and that's the goal.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Well, thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you for
great
the book.
To be with
let
you,
me
Marcus.
Just mention. Yeah, let me mention the book title with the subtitle. I didn't mention that earlier. It just kind of helps to find it on if you're going to go get it. It's called Renovated, and then the subtitle is God, Dallas Willard, and the Church That Transforms. And right, that's kind of what we've been talking about is being a church that transforms. So, Jim, thanks for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Wonderful being with you.
You know, one of the things that struck me in this conversation was discovering how much of our spiritual formation has to do with the experience of joy. We attach to people when we experience the joy of knowing that they are glad to see us. And we attach to God when we experience the joy of knowing that God is glad to be with us. And it's so true. As I think back, the most formative times of my life have been those times when I was with other people who loved Jesus and who were happy to be with me. It's just so clarifying for me, and I don't know if it is for you, but for me, right, just to learn that in order to help people develop a deeper connection to Jesus, what we need to do is create environments of joy, right? That's where attachment happens to each other and to God. And that's where mutual mind develops, which I love that concept, don't you? That's where mutual mind develops to each other and to God, where we begin to think and see the world with the mind of Christ. And that's also where we start fulfilling the purpose for which we were created, simply by being in tune with the God who made our brains. I don't know about you. I just love this conversation. And of course, we have so many more conversations with amazing guests here on Spiritual Life and Leadership. And so, you know, if you're new to the podcast, I want to invite you to scroll through the various guests and topics that we've had and just listen to the ones that look interesting to you. I also want to invite you to sign up for the Church Leadership Institute's monthly newsletter, where you'll be kept up to date on all of the great resources that we provide for ministry leaders. You can do that at www.dupree.org/church. And then finally, if you found this episode helpful, would you share it with someone you know? We'd also be really grateful if you would rate and review the podcast. That just makes this podcast more findable for others. Well, thanks so much for being here, and I'll see you next time here on Spiritual Life and Leadership.